Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
I want to particularly thank our major sponsors tonight, Winstead PC and Ernst & Young.
Jim and Talmadge, that was a wonderful introduction. I really appreciate it, both of you. It is a pleasure to be here at the Rosemont Crescent Hotel. What a beautiful place. And a pleasure to be at the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, to be in Dallas, Texas, to be specific, to be in the state of Texas, which is the state of, I was thinking flying in on the airplane today, the state of presidents. You know, I can remember a time, and this is dating myself a little bit, when Lyndon Johnson was considered to be sort of something brand new, something America had never seen, you know, this big, tall Texan and so forth. And then the second thought I had was, but a discerning biographer of or a discerning follower of the presidency in that period would have also noticed that Dwight Eisenhower was born in Denison, Texas, which qualified him as somewhat of a Texan. In fact, in 1952, when Eisenhower ran for president, he was not shy about being adopted by the state of Texas, by Kansas, by Pennsylvania, and New York. There were advantages in having three or four hometowns and or home states. My grandfather had several of them. Dwight Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson were more than people who were both born in Texas. They were also people who shared a great friendship. They were people who had an affinity for one another. They thought in many of the same ways. They had much in common. They had Sid Richardson of Fort Worth in common. They had Governor Alan Shivers in common. They had Robert Anderson, a former Treasury Secretary, in common. They had a senator, Senate colleague of Lyndon Johnson's, Prescott Bush, in common. And, of course, he had a son that interested Lyndon Johnson and Dwight Eisenhower, and that was George Herbert Walker Bush, who in turn had another son. So if you add Eisenhower and Johnson, and you add Bush and you add Bush, I think you have a dynasty forming here, or you certainly have a group of presidents, all of whom have a lot in common. Historians speak of the Virginia dynasty in American life. Perhaps we're passing through a Texas dynasty, and so it is indeed an honor to present this book here in Dallas, Texas tonight. Now, by way of background about Going Home to Glory, looking back to the summer of 1976, and this is 34 years ago, the title of the book proposal that Julie and I circulated among publishers in New York was Going Home to Glory. In the many decades since, we have had this story that we have wanted to share very, very much. This is a story that we have long wanted to tell. I will also say, and this is filling out Talmadge's biographical picture of me, I have always wanted to be a writer. In fact, I am one of the few published authors in America that can actually produce a copy of the first short story that I ever wrote. And the reason I can do that is because of the miracle of presidential records keeping in the White House. I was age 10 when a cousin, or I was age 9 when a cousin of mine came east from Chicago to visit us in the east, in Gettysburg to be exact, and she made a huge impression on me. And so I wrote a short story entitled Janet Stay. According to the records kept by the president's secretary, Ann C. Whitman, on July 15, 1958, David, age 10, that's me, I've just completed the story, walked in with a handwritten copy of a short story. Of course, I walked up to the president's secretary and said, please type this up. Ann Whitman typed up Janet Stay, produced a copy of this. We walked over to one of these newfangled Xerox machines and ran off 10 copies of Janet Stay. And as it turns out, July 15th, 1958 was a good day to be in the West Wing of the White House with the first copy, with a copy of the first short story you've ever written, because Marines were landing in Lebanon that morning. So you have a picture of the cabinet meeting and recessing, the National Security Council meeting and recessing. I stood outside the Oval Office, put this on sale for 15 cents a copy, and went through a first printing in about 30 minutes. This is also the first time I can remember meeting my father-in-law, Richard Nixon. And he walked up to me. He was wearing a gray suit. I admired him. He was a hero of mine. He says, well, David, what do you have here? And I said, I have a short story. And he says, how much does it cost? And I said, 15 cents. An aide reaches for 15 cents. He never carried money. 2 days later, I got what every writer needs. I got a letter from the Vice President of the United States saying, dear David, after dinner last night, the family gathered in the living room for a reading of Janet Stay. Mrs. Nixon and the girls want you to know that you're one of our very favorite authors. So not only have I always wanted to be a writer, not only have we had this story to tell for a long time, I felt that this is a story worth telling. The topic is the presidency in twilight, or the president in twilight, or what follows the White House. This is a topic which I think is significant. It has been shortchanged. I can name two books which I think are really outstanding in this field. Douglas Brinkley's The Unfinished Presidency about Jimmy Carter. One of our favorite recent books is Candace Millard's River of Doubt, which chronicles the restless Teddy Roosevelt in 1913, a vivid personality as he worked off the shock of his defeat in the 1912 general election by hazarding an exploration of the uncharted regions of the Amazon River, almost dying in the process. This is a fascinating character study which sheds a lot of light on Teddy Roosevelt the person. These are significant stories in a country, our country, which today under our 22nd Amendment requires our chiefs of state to step down after two terms, imposing limits on powerful and charismatic individuals who in many societies would rule permanently. They would not step down. What happens to these people? What kind of people are they? Thus, going home to glory begins literally January 20th, 1961, as expectant throngs gather in Washington for the inauguration of John Kennedy and the Eisenhowers plowing through the snows that blanket the area, make their way home to Gettysburg, driving past thousands of well-wishers on the roads between Washington and Gettysburg, roughly 70 miles of travel, for a family dinner at our home at the corner, on the corner of my grandfather's farm in Gettysburg. This is a very happy, sad night. I can remember when he came home. I can remember the grown-ups toasting the past and toasting the new life, which was beginning that night. Now, in the years that I chronicle in Going Home to Glory, Dwight Eisenhower is not leading an expedition towards a river of doubt, but he had reasons to doubt. In 1961, power had been transferred to the opposition party, and Dwight Eisenhower, as a former president, had few illusions what the narrow defeat of 1960 would mean for his political legacy and perhaps for the future of the country. Nor was he leaving an unfinished presidency, but he did have regrets. One of the things that my father said to me a long time ago, I don't remember when, but it always made an impression on me, is that it is impossible to have a job like the presidency and to leave that job without having regrets. It's impossible not to have regrets. There are also, of course, many, many satisfactions in being a former president. Going Home to Glory also chronicles a great deal of unfinished business, and there is always unfinished business that passes from presidency to presidency. In Berlin, in Laos, in Cuba in this era, free world forces and communist world forces face off in this confrontation at the very height of the Cold War, and Dwight Eisenhower will be drawn into support of the Kennedy administration and into consultations with John Kennedy, his young successor. Now, from Gettysburg, he will observe the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is probably the most dangerous moment of the Cold War. The passage of that crisis does usher in changing times. And Dwight Eisenhower, as a former president, will find himself involved with the leadership of both parties in 1963 as we become aware of changing times and the civil rights question becomes front and center in American national politics. He will be involved in 1964 as the Republican Party leadership takes the measure of this new conservative movement which appears that will, in time, greatly energize the Republican Party. They are coping with it, and they're trying to reconcile the appearance of this movement in 1964 with Dwight Eisenhower's objective of winning the 1964 election. That causes problems, which I chronicle in this book as well. Republicans in this period are improvising to convert the core principles of the movement that Barry Goldwater takes to San Francisco in 1964 into a winning and a governing formula. Vietnam starts in late 1964, and so in early 1965, late 64 and early 65, Dwight Eisenhower also emerges as a counselor to his old friend Lyndon Johnson. He is an active man, but his life inexorably and gradually becomes simpler, and it becomes quieter as he grows older. All along, I'm asking questions that Talmadge raises, and that is, I was conscious that he was a very important man at a very young age. Americans liked Ike. Why did they like Ike? Well, one advantage in providing a profile of a former president is that a former president is an individual who is easier to know than a sitting president. The layers of staff and officialdom no longer surround a president. And so it is possible to glimpse at this individual and to ask the question, what is it that made him a very outstanding leader? A question that I ask many times. We were neighbors in this period. And so I recall him, of course, as a general, as an elder statesman, but I also recall him as a farmer, as a hunter, as a painter, as a golfer, as a former ball player. And I watched a lot of ball with my grandfather on Saturday afternoons, as a sage and as a supervisor and eventually as a companion and a friend as he became confined and as his health deteriorated. Knowing him in the role of worker and supervisor and so forth was perhaps one of the telling relationships I had. I started work in 1958 at 25 cents an hour. At the Eisenhower Farm. The Eisenhower Farm is now an historic site. You can visit it, and if you do, please admire the fences. I painted them five times. I tell in this story about getting started and all the enthusiasm I felt in the summer of 1958, and then a lapse in the summer of 1963 when I became exposed to the general and Dwight Eisenhower. A couple of farmhands and I were playing bridge, and this carried a little bit long past the deadline over lunch hour. We thought we didn't know that Granddad was on the ground. Suddenly he walks through the door, and anybody who's ever experienced Dwight Eisenhower's temper probably has a similar story. I didn't really hear him, but I did make out three words: "You are fired." I made my way home. I had a golf date with him later that afternoon. I didn't know what the fallout from this episode was going to be, and so I sort of waited anxiously, and about 3:30 the car rolls up. So I go out and join him. We ride to Gettysburg Country Club in silence. We play the first hole in silence. We play the second hole in silence. Finally, on the third hole, a par five, he says, "David, I allow my associates one mistake a year, and you've had yours." And so I find myself rehired on the third hole, proving that to err is human and to forgive divine. I was with him as the appreciation, I think, for the Eisenhower years began to grow. This has been a gradual thing over many years, but by the mid-60s, and you quoted the Husaiti article, people are looking back on the Eisenhower years as times of peace and prosperity, of stability. This is, and we are at a World Affairs Council. We have a very active one in Philadelphia as well. a phrase that I will borrow from international relations. It is a kind of long piece which provides a setting for great innovation in America. In the 1950s, we enter the space age, the computer age, the atomic age. America constructs its interstate highway system, tens of thousands of schools. We adopt entirely new living patterns. The growth of our suburbs and so forth is phenomenal in the 1950s. I think in 1955, there is an article in Time magazine, a survey of America in 1955, that points out that that year, one in five Americans will voluntarily move in America. This is the greatest mass migration in history every year in our country, and it is an entirely voluntary one. This is a country which, in the words of Time magazine, is as frisky as a young colt. This is a wonderful time, and this is all advanced by wise and careful planning. Dwight Eisenhower lived to experience the satisfaction of knowing that America was, on balance, winning the peace at home as well as abroad. Now, he could also take satisfaction from a resurgent Republican Party in the 1960s. You know, in 1961, when he returns to Gettysburg, he had plenty of occasion to wonder whether the pundits and the officialdom in Washington were correct, thinking of his presidency as an anomaly. By the end of the decade, he lived to experience the certainty that the Eisenhower presidency was not an anomaly. It was a first. He was not only arguably the first Texan, he was the first Republican in a long line of Republican presidencies which have served in the course of five decades since. Now, the Republican revival in the 1960s is how I encountered my With. This is a book by David Eisenhower, With Julie Eisenhower. I had met Julie several times as a boy. I met her at the 57 inaugural. I met her at the 1959 opener. We can prove that with pictures. I don't remember her from the 59 inaugural. I was too busy getting autographs and so forth. But we turned up at college about 7 miles apart. Now, she is at Smith College. I am at Amherst College. And we were bound to meet sooner or later. I was going to put that off as long as I could. My grandmother was very strong that I should go meet Julie. She had met her in August, liked her, and I was hesitant. I just didn't want to get involved. I didn't want to put her on the spot. Finally, a Republican group contacted the two of us and asked us to make a joint appearance. We decided to coordinate our replies. I called on her, liked her instantly. Took her out for a dish of ice cream, discovered I'd spent all my money on the cab getting over there, so she picks up the tab. the first time I did get up the nerve, I liked her so much, I went back to see her in about 4 or 5 weeks. This was as the election night 1966 is approaching, and I had one of these exchanges that would deter a relationship going much further. Smith Baldwin House had a proctor system. A senior was on duty downstairs, a female. You have the picture of this girl in long straight hair and horn-rimmed glasses and so on. And I check in to call on Julie, and I walk up to her and say, "I am David Eisenhower, and I would like to see Julie Nixon." She gives me a long look and says, "Well, my name is Harry Truman." So that did happen. But I persisted, and so step by step, I found myself drawn into this exciting political world. This is Dwight Eisenhower's world, which I had missed out on as a young grandson. But now I am seeing a national campaign and how a national campaign works. And I am seeing a presidency develop. I am seeing a mission for that presidency being articulated in a very fateful campaign, 1968. I am seeing the connections that I will develop as an historian between Korea of the Eisenhower years, Vietnam of the Johnson and Nixon years, and the role each of these conflicts played in the wider cause of ending wars and winning the peace in the 1970s and 1980s. I I think that we have pursued this project for another reason as well, and that is I've emphasized the public Eisenhower and my interest in that subject and my exposure to him as a former president. But I think as important as any legacy that one would carve in the public sphere and so forth is the legacy that one leaves within one's own family. Last week, Julie and I had an extended interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is doing a major piece on this book, and the reporter, Art Carey, arrived with an unpublished book that he and his sisters had written about their grandfather. This is a family event or a ritual in a way that I've encountered in a number of contexts. People will do this from time to time. They feel a need to make a record of an individual, somebody who's really made a difference in their lives or really given them a priceless gift of some kind or another. There is a deep need to acknowledge such people, and we felt that need as well, and we've done so in this book. There is no effort in this book to alter the historical image of the general and the commanding officer of World War II. There is no effort to alter the image of Dwight Eisenhower as president. Our purpose, my purpose, is to expand this image and to make a record of other times for which he should be remembered as well. Times when it was possible to know Dwight Eisenhower as a person, to receive his advice regularly and his tips for healthy living, his guidance and support, to appreciate his enthusiasms, to see the personal example he set of serenity in faith and his frank acceptance of his limitations and infirmities as time went on, to know his optimism and to weigh what it was about this person that could shoulder such immense responsibilities as he did. And it was to see his deep faith in America's future. Why did Americans like Ike? Why was he a great man? He was a great man in the final analysis because he was a good man. He was a good man in small things as well as large things. He was a good man in private as well as public. We are here tonight at the World Affairs Council in Dallas, and I would conclude my formal remarks by presenting two larger considerations that were on my mind as I completed this book and are on my mind tonight as I think about the topic. Why study history? Not everybody reads it. History provides the study of history, and the writing of it provides, I think, great assurance. History cannot provide a guide for the future. I've been asked many times about my grandfather's prophetic farewell address and so on, and we're about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of that address. What does this say to us today? I'm not sure that a speech or even history provides specific guidance for today, but what it does do is it builds confidence in today and confidence in our future. I know that Americans, and this is something that we sense back east, and I know that this is these are challenging times for the United States today. But with even a casual survey of history, whether you're reading novels or whether you're reading prose, whether you're reading history of American politics or history of American business, such a reader cannot substantially doubt that the United States will emerge from the difficulties that we face now as a nation that is stronger than ever. And I return to another point that I've made a little bit earlier. It may seem strange that the nation which has assumed the leading role in world affairs imposes time limits on its chief of state and effectively builds in a certain discontinuity of personality in leadership in the administration of national affairs. I think this serves as a reminder that continuity in America is a continuity not of people necessarily, but of ideals and of beliefs, of faith and of the spontaneous and free actions of a free people and of leaders in many regions in America and in many communities and at many levels. American history as a whole is a broad highway that points to the future. And this is those fortunate enough to be Americans today are building that future, and they ride on this highway definitely on a path to glory. It has been said many times that the 1960s were a good time to be alive. I think today is a good time to be alive, and I think that it will always be a good time to be an American. What we do know is that today is the right time for us to be telling this story. And so I deeply appreciate this chance to be here in Dallas to present to the World Affairs Council, Going Home to Glory. Thank you very much.
Great. The question is, how would your grandfather feel about President Obama's policy towards Iraq and Afghanistan?
Oh, boy. Well, that's why I said history cannot be a guide for the future, but build confidence in the future. How would Dwight Eisenhower have, how would he have responded to this notion of limited or protracted war in distant theaters? You know, actually, one of the things that I really enjoyed doing in updating a draft that we had, I told this story many years ago, actually, and dictated it, large parts of it. And I went back to it as an historian and documented it. One of the fascinating paper treasures that I used in putting together Going Home to Glory were the consultations between President Johnson and Dwight Eisenhower on Vietnam. Dwight Eisenhower had a very simple answer for Vietnam, and that was win. Put pressure on the other side. Do what you can to push this thing to a conclusion immediately. America cannot sustain an effort on the scale of Vietnam in a distant theater. That was his advice. That is the way he urged Johnson to move. On the other hand, and this is a kind of way of looking at the scope of this career, he had served under Douglas MacArthur for 3 or 4 years in the Philippines in the 1930s. And the Philippines then, as they may even be today, were waging a counterinsurgency effort in the southern islands against Muslim guerrillas, the so-called, I'm not sure what they're, Hucks or whatever. And he was aware of counterinsurgency doctrines. He had studied them. He had actually helped train the Filipino 1st Division in these techniques and so forth. He is, for that matter, the first American proconsul, if you want to look at it, in America's historic first step in becoming a Mideast power. When Allied forces land in North Africa, 1942, Dwight Eisenhower is commanding these forces. He becomes the governor, in effect the military governor of Algeria, Morocco, and several other Muslim states in North Africa. He became very acquainted with this problem of development and bringing nations sort of into the modern age and mixing force, politics, nation-building strategies and so forth to bring this about. I feel certain that the kind of advice that Dwight Eisenhower would be offering his contemporaries in public I think the kind of pressure that he'd be bringing to bear on political leadership is once we commit ourselves to the use of force, that we bring hostilities to a conclusion as soon as possible. This was his philosophy towards Korea. We are a democracy. We cannot sustain intermediate-level conflicts perpetually, everywhere, all the time. I think that was a matter of principle with him. By the same token, he was understanding, and in the case of President Johnson, this was a very fruitful partnership. Dwight Eisenhower had views. He advanced them. He also understood the complexity of the situation as President Johnson saw it, and ultimately he was supportive, not judgmental. So as a Afghanistan and Iraq, these are areas that concerned him as a president. There was a coup d'etat in Iraq in July of 1958, which caused the overthrow of the Hashemite dynasty. A junta of colonels come to power, and according to the meetings that were going on in the White House on July 15th, 1958, Alan Dulles, as director of CIA, reports to Dwight Eisenhower that the new Iraqi regime is pledging the liberation of Kuwait as Iraq's 19th province as the first great task to be undertaken by the regime. It is in the next moment that Dwight Eisenhower orders Marines to land in Lebanon. It is shortly after that that I put Janet Stay on sale outside the Oval Office. In other words, he's a man of vast experience in these matters. Force makes a difference in the world. It has to be employed. It is tragic, and it has to be employed as effectively as possible. That's something that, and the political leadership has to make up its mind.
Thank you very much. My father was a captain in the Army Air Corps. He dropped the Pathfinders on D-Day the night before. He actually got to meet your grandfather several times at veterans events afterwards, and he was very, very impressed by him. Can you tell us specifically what are the leadership qualities, in your opinion, that made him into a fantastic, a great commander and a great president?
That's which qualities? Well, you have virtues, justice, wisdom, temperance, courage. They say courage crowns the virtues. The man I am seeing right now, the man I describe in Going Home to Glory, is about as fearless a human being as you can be. I'm not saying that he lacked fear. In fact, I even describe an instance where I felt I thought something was crossing his eyes or whatever in the grips of doctors and the suffering that he had at the end of his life. But he's as close to fearless a human being as I've ever known. And that is something that stems from, it stems from exposing yourself to certain experiences. I think we can train people to cope with situations when they're children. This is one reason why we have school athletics and so forth. It is ultimately, I think, and this is what Going Home to Glory is about, it's a question of faith, a belief that everything will work out, a belief that there is a cause larger than yourself out there worth saving, a belief that ultimately everything is on a road to something that we live and strive for. It was this combination of things. He was fearless, and that made him a leader. That is the essence of it. I talked to ministers about this. I talked to Billy Graham at length. I talked to Dean Miller, who was his pastor in Southern California, Robert McCaskill, who was his pastor in Gettysburg, the Reverend Elson, who was pastor of the National Presbyterian Church in Washington. And what they urged on me was to emphasize this. They see this quality in leaders, and I certainly saw it in him.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
It's my understanding on the eve of the invasion of Europe, your grandfather wrote two letters. One letter was a letter of congratulations to the multinational troops, assuming the invasion would be a success. The second letter was a letter of resignation,
right,
in the event the invasion was a failure. What can we do as citizens of America today to instill upon our leaders the concept of responsibility, even though you may not have had a personal direct right involvement in the failure?
Well, I think one question he asked, and I think it's a secret to his, one thing is what qualities about this individual inspired military organizations. That's a question I talked to military leaders all the time I was doing interviews for Going Home to Glory. I talked to a lot of American commanders. For instance, one thing that they ranked very high about Field Marshal Montgomery, who is a controversial figure in American history. This is the British Field Marshal that Eisenhower had to supervise as a Supreme Commander during the European theater. The Montgomery legends are legion. But what all the American commanders rated highly about him was his ability to inspire troops. And as professionals, they ranked him very highly. All right, that's the quality that I'm talking about when I refer to Dwight Eisenhower's fearlessness. The other quality that you're talking about is leadership and how you contribute your leadership talents to making a great enterprise or a great organization work. And my father has a very interesting answer to that, and I pursued this in going home in Eisenhower at War. This is a major book that I wrote on World War II some years ago. And that was Dwight Eisenhower. And this D-Day note is very typical of this. What he's saying to himself as somebody who's being promoted through an organization is, how can I be useful to this organization? And what he proved early on to Franklin Roosevelt during the North African landings is that he was willing to relieve political authority of the need to step in and to do controversial things. The action that paved the way for the landing of American forces, practically without the firing of a shot in North Africa in November 1942, was a political accord that Eisenhower and his assistant, Mark Wayne Clark, who is covered in Going Home to Glory, reached with Admiral Darlan, who was a Vichy French. I think he was second in the Vichy command, and he happened to be in North Africa. We were probably in touch with him before the landings, but he turns up in North Africa. We strike a bargain with him. He makes a separate peace on behalf of the Vichy authority in North Africa, and we land. The press almost drove Eisenhower out of his command over this. This is the equivalent of dealing with terrorists. This is trucking with fascism. This is something that our command, we cannot taint our crusade by doing this. This is something that Eisenhower anticipated Roosevelt and Churchill would approve of, but he also understood that they could not do it. And so he sacrificed his reputation for the good of for the larger cause. He was prepared to do that. And it was because of that, my father's convinced, that Roosevelt chose him to command Overlord. And the existence of that note vindicates that choice in those very terms. Had Overlord failed, the United States and the British would have figured out a way to open another front somewhere else, probably within 9 to 12 months. We would have found ways perhaps to conceal the dimensions of that disaster. And the one thing that the commander of that operation was not going to do was to try to assign blame elsewhere for the failure of that operation. The commander was going to cooperate with that. Anything to make this work. This is the way he approached it. How can I be useful? And that's exactly what he is, as he's preparing himself spiritually for a setback on Normandy. And that was a very hard thing for him to do. He was a human being. But what he said to my Uncle Milton once, this is a story that Milton told a lot, and I really enjoyed it. Milton was president of Penn State in the mid-1950s, and Dwight Eisenhower's brother is president, and Milton arranges for his brother to address the Penn State commencement. And it's going to be held outdoors. As you know, Penn State is a huge university. It's probably the size of the University of Texas. And as the that morning, there is inclement weather that is going to drive this ceremony indoors. And Milton is running around fussing. And he says, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm so worried and so forth. And Ike, do you have any advice and so forth? And Ike just beamed and smiled. And he says, Milton, since June 6, 1944, I've never worried about the rain.
Grandfather spoke of the military-industrial complex. Could you comment on that?
Now, that's a very interesting. January 17th, 72 hours before this book starts, Dwight Eisenhower from the Oval Office delivers a farewell address. 72 hours later, John Kennedy from the east portico of the Capitol delivers an inaugural address. In a poll of 20th century. In a poll of rhetoric professors about American speech in the 20th century, these two speeches, led first by John Kennedy and then the Eisenhower, is ranked about 2 points below, are among the top 10 speeches delivered by an American anywhere in the 20th century. Two great speeches within 72 hours of each other, apparently addressing one another. There is actually an interesting story about both, and I'm aware of both because I run a program that investigates, that actually does significant research into speeches. There's a story about the Eisenhower speech, and it contains this warning against the unwarranted acquisition of influence by a military-industrial complex. What does that mean, and what thrust, what effect does that warning have? Early in my researches on the Eisenhower years, I encountered drafts of that speech, which have since been retired from research. Now, they are not available for research now, but I was given access to them. They are part of the annex, or they are part of the appendices in the research body for my grandfather's memoirs. And these 40 drafts tell a story. The first third of these drafts are reflect the disappointment that Eisenhower and the Republicans felt about Nixon's narrow loss to Kennedy in 1960. And in effect, what the military-industrial complex and these warnings mean, they are part of a larger warning Eisenhower is issuing against his successor. Essentially what he's saying is watch out for these people who have made too much of the emergency facing this country, who have over-dramatized the Soviet threat, who have denigrated American strengths and have stirred the American people up for no reason. Watch out for them. Somebody gets to the president and says, you can't do that. So for the next third of drafts, you see all the qualifications. What I meant to say on one hand, on the other hand, and so forth, and you see him falling back from this point as the president is sort of turned around on this. You may not criticize your successor. You should not. Your job is to make your successor's job easier, not harder. Even Truman did this for you, and so on and so on. I think that he yielded on that point rather easily. Then somebody gets to the president, or the president himself understands, that a farewell address is not about the future. It's not even about the past, though the past is the subject. It is timeless. What a farewell address seeks is timelessness. And so what Eisenhower does suddenly is he turns his gaze instead of towards what is to come. He looks back, and he begins to meditate on the great riddle of the 20th century. How is it that our civilization in the 20th century could combine such technological material progress and growth with tragedies on the scale of World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II? There's a sense that faced all the leadership of that era that democracy was maybe not adequate and so forth. What is the great lesson? And the lesson that Eisenhower drew, looking back on his time, was the reason that moderate systems failed in Europe, the reason that the tools of war or whatever overtook everybody else, is that people in those countries ceased being citizens. It is a speech about citizenship, and it is a speech for the ages. And what it says, in effect, is we will always be confronted with claims on us, claims to lead for one reason or another, either because we have superior expertise or we know more, or something. And what he's saying is, in the final analysis, what a citizen does is a citizen takes responsibility for one's own life. They educate themselves, improve themselves as much as possible, and so forth. And in the final analysis, they hold this attitude in public life. If I don't understand it, I have a right to question it. And if it does not meet my sense of where we ought to go, I have a right to object and to work against it. Be citizens. Do not yield the power of decision over to a military-industrial complex or any other complex. Be a citizen. So he looks back, and John Kennedy, 72 hours later, bombarded with suggestions that he praise Eisenhower in his outgoing speech, that he call for continuity, offer continuity, that he invite Republicans into his government. Instinctively, as Eisenhower understood his role on January 17th, Kennedy understands his role on January 20th. It is not to applaud the past is to lead America into the future. In the Kennedy drafts, what you see is the early drafts are looking back towards Eisenhower and the fact of his popularity and the fact that they're going to have to be reckoning with him and trying to make some sort of peace with him. And what you see is an about-face, and the later drafts are looking to the future, and you have a masterpiece of an inaugural that brings an administration into being. Eisenhower is saying goodbye. Kennedy is saying hello. And you have these two great speeches back-to-back within 72 hours, the two greatest, among the two greatest delivered in the 20th century.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.